Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. On today's Fresnolandia, we are joined by Christine Barker, who is the executive director of FIRM, which stands for Fresno Immigrant and Refugee Ministries.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
We're so glad to have you. Just a little disclosure for our listeners. Christine is a member of the Fresnoland Board of Directors. That does not mean that she has any say whatsoever on our editorial content. We just know the work that she does on refugees is really interesting, which is why we wanted to have her on the podcast.
Perfect. And I want to start by with definitions, because I often hear people use refugees and asylum seekers interchangeably, mm-hmm. but they're distinct categories with different legal definitions. So can you unpack that nuance for us?
Yeah. So I'm gonna zoom us out even more real quick with another word that gets thrown around and means a lot of different things. So when we talk about immigrants or we talk about immigration, I start this in all the presentations that I do. An immigrant is literally anyone who lives in a different country than the one they were born in. And any of us could be immigrants at some point in time in our lives if we are not already. My brother is an immigrant who lives in another country that is not the United States. And sometimes it's thrown around as if it is a bad word, and it is just a literal factual
word. It defines someone's location.
Locationally, yeah. Based on where you were born, nothing more. And so when we're talking about refugees and we're talking about asylum seekers, refugees are folks who have been pushed out of their country of origin to another country, usually first, like just across a border. And the reason that they're pushed out has something to do with who they are. So there's a 1951 convention that defines what a refugee is, and that is someone who is outside of their country of origin, who is unwilling or unable to go back to their country of origin because of a legitimate fear of persecution or death based on some part of who they are. So that could be nationality, that could be religion, that could be political beliefs, that could be membership in a particular social group. And the government of the country that they are born in is unwilling or unable to protect them from that threat.
Could I just ask a question about this? So you did not mention economic status or economic situation, but a lot of times someone's economic situation is directly related to sort of those identities that you mentioned. How does that get parsed out?
Sure. This definition comes out of a particular point in time, which is World War II, where there was extensive persecution of Jews, of Roma, of gay and lesbian, and members of unions and political dissidents. And no country was willing to take these people as they were fleeing this persecution, that everyone knew what was happening. So in 1951, when the world was still on the page, that was bad, and we didn't want that to happen again. That's what this definition comes from. So there are lots of people in the refugee world who have written lots of papers and talked about a lot, like how do we update this definition based on the world we live in now? You'll also notice that definition doesn't say anything about war, but it does say if the government is unable to protect you from that persecution or death. So war is another thing that in our minds we think, oh, you fled war, of course you're a refugee. But the international legal definition is like messier than that.
And is that the definition that the US has historically adopted as well? In defining refugees?
It took the US a long time to adopt that as a definition. It took until the 1980 Refugee Act for that to be the adopted definition. But real quick before, I will come back to 1980 because it's a really important year for FIRM and for Fresno and for a lot of the communities that make Fresno home. But the only difference between someone who comes to the US on a refugee visa and someone who has approved asylum status inside the US is where that determination was made. So everyone who comes to the US as a refugee, multiple someones outside of the US made sure they met that legal definition before the US ever extended that visa to them. People who are seeking asylum enter the US on another status, and once they are here, they request, either proactively or in response to being ordered deported, protection from being sent back to that country for the exact same reasons. So that 1951 legal definition, the only difference that they're supposed to be is whether in the U.S. is whether they are claiming that status once they are already here on another visa or have been paroled in or have another way of entering, or if that determination was made and then as a result of that determination, the U.S. extended the refugee visa to that person.
So asylum is about someone electing to come, and refugee, you have some kind of third party mediating that. Is that an accurate way to describe it?
Asylum is something that an immigration judge in the U.S. or an asylum officer can determine.
Okay.
It's a status.
Okay.
And it is a status that leads to permanent residence, that leads to citizenship. Most of the refugees of the world have no hope of ever coming to the U.S. There's over 100 million people displaced across the world. A third of them have formal refugee status and have been recognized as that. Under Biden, which right now is apparently the end of the world, the U.S. made it to 100,000 people in 1 year as refugees.
Okay.
When there's 33 million refugees right now in the world.
So across the globe, we have historically just received a very small
amount. A minuscule percentage of the number of people who legally meet that international legal definition. The vast majority of refugees are living in countries nearby the country that they fled. So Pakistan, Iran, Turkey host so many more refugees than the U.S. has resettled in the entire 50 years that the U.S. has had a formal resettlement process.
Okay, interesting.
So
Kenya as well.
So if we're talking about, because the asylum process is often in the news as being broken.
Someone can file paperwork to seek asylum and they cannot go before the judge for 10 years or 11 years or 15 years. Whereas in other countries, like Canada, I lived in Canada for a year working with people seeking asylum in Canada. You went before a judge within 9 months, and the judge said, yep, you qualify, or nope, you don't. And then you had a limited amount of time to be like, okay, can I appeal this? Or, you know what, I thought Canada was going to be awesome, but really it's freaking cold here. I'm going to see what other options I have, and I'm going to move on. I think that the incredibly unfair thing about our asylum system in the U.S. is that we force people to wait for so long, and like a lot can happen in 10 years, right? Like you can get married, you can have kids, you can get a job. Like you have all of these roots that once those roots are in place, it's so much harsher to tear families apart as opposed to have an immigration system that you actually invest in, that has judges, that has courts, that has support, where people get a decision faster and then they can decide what they're going to do with that decision.
Yeah. So let's jump to Firm now.
Sure.
How did Firm get involved with refugee resettlement?
So Firm was founded in the beginnings of Firm were in the late 80s and early 90s. You remember how I said 1980 was the Refugee Act? Mm-hmm. It's very important because 1975 is when all of the U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia fell apart, right? So Vietnam fell, Laos fell, and the beginnings of some of the horrible things that happened in Cambodia also were underway. And so we had, the American people really saw the necessity of supporting Southeast Asians who were impacted by the U.S. intervention in Southeast Asia and brought refugees over, Hmong, Lao, Vietnamese, and then later Cambodian. And so there wasn't really a formal system in place, and there wasn't really formal support for refugees. So in 1980, the U.S. got on board, passed the 1980 Refugee Act, and created a system with a threshold of how many refugees per year and like what services refugees really need in order to adjust to life in America. And so a lot of what we do today as a country and then also as Firm goes back to this 1980 Act where they said, yeah, kids need access to after-school programming, youth need mentorship, adults need extra employment support. There should be refugee cash assistance for the first couple months that you're in the United States. You should have access to health insurance the first couple months you're in the United States. So we have this like statutory framework that is in the law, that is required by the law, that Congress has not appealed yet. We'll come up with that later. But so 1980s, we start seeing more and more families coming to Fresno who have fled the violence and war and new communist governments in Southeast Asia. And then starting in the 90s, you also see more family sponsorship. So maybe one person comes as a refugee, and then they can, once they're a little settled, then they can bring their brother. And then once their brother's settled, they can bring their other brother, and then you can bring your other sister. And so you see this huge growth of Southeast Asian Americans in Fresno during the 80s and 90s, but not a lot of resources.
And they were drawn to the region, as I've read, primarily for a big agricultural region, very similar mm-hmm. in some ways to what they were used to.
Yeah, access to land is really important, and then also clan structure. So okay. originally the U.S. was trying to spread refugees as thinly as possible, thinking that would help people acclimate faster, and that was really lonely. And people began to secondarily and tertiarily, thirdly, move to Fresno to be close to family and to draw. And access to land and being able to farm was really important as well. Okay. So 1994, a firm was founded by Reverend Dr. Sharon Stanley Ray, along with a group of refugee pastors who were already working in refugee communities here. Ukrainians, Ethiopians, Hmong, Lao, pastors who all saw the incredible needs of the communities that they were leading and didn't really have a way to access the resources that people needed. And so FIRM primarily was like a way for people to come together. And Sharon was really good at bringing in resources from all over to build, to respond to the needs of refugee communities. And we've just grown bigger and bigger from there.
Okay, let's do a user experience. Sure. So say someone's resettling in Fresno. Okay. What's it gonna be like for them? Take us through the process.
Okay, so we have to go back in time a year in order for that us to imagine that, because resettlement is canceled right now. There's no resettlement happening under the current administration. But if you'd asked me this question a year ago, maybe 6 weeks before someone was scheduled to arrive in the U.S., FIRM would receive a notification. This family of five is going to arrive on the airport on this date at this time. Here's who they already know in Fresno. It's their cousin. It's their brother. It's their friend. What we would do is we'd reach out to that U.S. tie and say, hey.
Who decides where they land?
It's a great question. So there are 10 national resettlement agencies. A year ago, there were 10 national resettlement yep. agencies. And they have weekly meetings with all of the upcoming arrivals. They look at who's operating in what cities. And for people who have U.S. ties, the goal is always to resettle them close to someone they know. And then they see who has capacity, and then people who have no U.S. ties, they look at what communities are already existing in some cities, and so they'll try to send people there. But sometimes it's truly just like, you haven't had a family for a while. Here's a family.
Got it.
Yeah.
So they'll just drop someone just in a place.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. With a resettlement agency that's contracted, that's skilled, okay. that has the training and the support to help people.
Okay. So you yeah. guys get notification 6 mm-hmm. weeks out. This is when they're going to arrive. Yeah. This is who they know. Mm-hmm. Then what?
So we call the U.S. tie and we say, hey, is your family going to live with you? What's the plan? And if the U.S. says, yes, I haven't seen my sister in 15 years. I'm not going to let them out of my sight. We're like, great. You think you're going to not let them out their sight for 3 days or 3 weeks or like forever? What are we thinking here? And so based on that information, then we start looking for housing, and then we start looking for furnishings for the housings, because the goal is that when someone arrives in Fresno, we meet their plane, we welcome them to Fresno, we take them to their new apartment that is already furnished, that has culturally appropriate food, that has a hot meal waiting, has groceries for the week, and we say, welcome, this is your new home. And then from there, we have intake, and we sign leases, and we do a lot of cultural orientation, get people connected to benefits, to services, get kids in schools, get adults in ESL. There's like a whole laundry list of required activities that have to happen
services, yeah.
within the first 90 days that someone is in the country.
Can I ask you about the housing? How do you select, find, secure housing? How does that work?
It was very difficult. It's the one thing we're slightly relieved that we don't have to do right now, because it was really hard. So we develop relationships with landlords. We help them understand that even though someone has no rental history and no income, that we are here and we're going to support them, and we're going to make sure that they have enough income to pay their rent. And if there's any issues, we're going to be there to help mediate. We're going to make sure they pay their rent. We're going to make sure they know all the rules. Like, we promise a lot of things to landlords in the hopes that they will give us a chance and give this family a chance.
Is Fresno pretty friendly landlord-wise? In the aggregate, what's been your experience?
Once you find a good landlord, you just keep working with them. That's how I'll answer that question.
And what about how someone, so you sign up kids for school, they sign up for ESL classes. What does it look like, or what has it historically looked like? I know it's on pause right now, to have someone go from not speaking the language to then working, being a part of Fresno's daily culture.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. It's really hard. I think the first couple of weeks that anyone, I think this is true for any of us, I don't think this is specific to refugees, but like the first couple of weeks you're somewhere new, you're like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. This is so beautiful. The grass is so green. The sky is so blue. Like everything tastes better here. And then after a couple of weeks, you're like, oh my God, this is nothing like what I'm used to. What is this? So you have like culture shock on top of language barriers, on top of culture differences. And I would say it takes probably a year for people to start to feel like this is actually home. For some families, it can happen faster. For other families, it can take longer. And I think it's really hard when you've only seen America in the movies to adjust.
And Fresno's not typically featured in the movies.
Fresno's not super famous in
more
the
American
Hollywood
graffiti
movies.
Showing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's rough, but we know that what works and what helps people is knowing that other people care about them. So if we have volunteers at the time that can come and just do 1 hour a week English practice, like that helps a lot for people just to know they haven't been forgotten in this strange place. We do a lot of peer support groups. Firm does monthly in-language workshops in all of the major languages spoken by our refugee communities. And then that's an opportunity for communities to come together and learn from one another and commiserate and also encourage one another. We do family field trips to get used to the many amenities that we have here in California. And there's ongoing case management. So like the reception and placement, the first 90 days, is like really intense and really structured, but we know that 90 days is not nearly enough. So there are many other programs at Firm and many other staff at Firm that can continue to support for as long as people want it and need it. Once people start working, it's a lot easier. I think it's really hard when you don't have work to go to and you just have a couple appointments a week, you're just stuck at home all the time.
That's what I was going to ask
about everything
next,
that is worrying you. And that's not great for anyone.
What? Are people coming? Presumably many of them have professional jobs in their home country. Are they finding work in their same field, or is there a lot of adjustment to a different type of work?
There's a lot of disappointment.
Yeah.
We have people, I would say, especially from Afghanistan, but also from Ukraine, who were really building their country and like building their democracies and were relatively high up, which is what puts them at risk, especially for the Afghan. That is why they are a refugee now, is because of how impactful their work was before. So we have a couple people who have gotten jobs as engineers, which is really exciting because we like need a lot of engineers right now. We actually have a good number of engineers coming from Afghanistan, but it just takes a lot of time and support to understand how to explain your experience, even if you speak perfect English, like to translate how you look for work in Afghanistan to how you get a job in the more formal California.
Yeah, I'm curious about employers and like how they perceive people with different credentials from different countries and what they see as transferable.
Yeah, me too, Jordan. Me too.
Do you talk to employers? Do you work with them in this kind of process?
I do sometimes, and then my staff definitely does a lot. But I think there is a lot of misunderstanding and misperception about anyone who immigrated here being work authorized and not understanding that people can be work authorized and an immigrant at the same time, and that refugees can just literally work based on their I-94 refugee status. They don't have to wait to have a green card or wait. There's a lot of misunderstanding that it takes a long time to overcome. And I think some people choose to focus on their education for the first couple of years to try to just get recredentialed here to be in a similar field. I feel really, out of everyone, I feel the most sorry for the folks who were doctors in Afghanistan. We had a lot of women who were like OBGYNs, and like their best hope here is to become a sonographer. And even that takes a year.
And the need for doctors.
Yeah.
Is
there's
so
such
high.
A need for doctors in our
shortage.
Region.
Oh,
yeah.
That's frustrating.
But like the credentialing thing is... people smarter than me have been working on that a really long time, and it's still a hot mess.
Sure.
Yeah.
So That's all pre-Trump.
Sure.
What, tell us about what has happened in the days and months following President Trump getting elected again.
Yeah. So I think a lot has happened since January. Some of it we maybe could have predicted based on what was said on the campaign trail. There's still a lot of misunderstanding on what asylum means and what refugee means, and that asylum is a political immigration status. It has nothing to do with mental health.
People still think that?
Our president still thinks
that. Okay.
He hasn't said it out loud recently. I don't know. I cannot speculate what our president thinks or does not think. On the campaign trail, there was a lot of allegations that people on parole had escaped insane asylums, which is a mixture of a lot of different terms that doesn't really match the reality of people that I know who came on parole, of people that I know that applied for asylum and received it, of people that I know that applied for asylum and didn't receive it, and people who came as refugees.
Let's pick out one of Trump's claims. So one of Trump's claims is that Biden relaxed the refugee process. Is there any validity to that, or is that just like a political football that's being thrown around?
Firm was not a resettlement agency until Biden intentionally said we need more resettlement agencies. So Biden intentionally invested in rebuilding the refugee resettlement infrastructure in our country that had been devastated by under the previous administration and then again by COVID. And even with all of that investment, we only welcomed 100,000 people out of the 33 million people in the world that technically qualified. So it's hard for me to even evaluate that claim because it is so far.
Yes, he did more than previous administrations to accommodate refugees, but compared to the need and the scale of the problem, it's just
to me, it's fractional. Embarrassingly low.
Sure.
Yeah.
And has his stance been total and utter dismantling of all refugee programming, or what's been the approach so far?
So Firm received a stop work order in January. It was January 24th, ordering us to stop services to refugees who had already arrived, despite the fact that those are mandated by the refugee law. That was in court. It is still in court. If you want to nerd out on that, it's Pasito v. Trump is the court case going on still in Seattle. We were very fortunate that we have a lot of local support, and so, and a brave board, and our board said, you know what, people need our help, we're Firm, we have a lot of different funding sources. If the administration is saying we can't use federal funds to do these services, we're not going to stop helping people just because one funding source is cut off.
Percentage-wise, what does that look like for you guys?
The R&P contract?
Yeah, the federal funding that comes to Firm.
Oh, federal funding that comes to Firm is more than 50% of our budget right now. The R&P contract was like maybe 8% of our total contract.
So it's a hit, but it's not devastating your organization at this point.
Sure. Yeah, sure. And then in the end, it turns out that the judge agreed with us that these services were required and they did need to be provided. Trump has not allowed in any more refugees since January 24th, even though he's been ordered repeatedly by the courts to reopen refugee resettlement, particularly for people who were already booked to come for to travel in late January and early.
And I know February. Giselle Medina on our team reported on a family in Armenia.
They sold everything.
Yeah, could you just tell the story a little bit more for our listeners?
Yeah, so one of the families that had travel booked to Fresno are related. They're from Armenia, and they have relatives here in Fresno who are anxiously awaiting for them. They'd been waiting years and years and years for their family to join them here. They had figured out housing, they'd figured out everything, and then the travel was canceled. And this family had already sold everything they'd owned, they'd quit their jobs, they were ready to come to the U.S. They had everything ready, their family here was like ready for them to go. And with very little communication, their travel was canceled and they were given absolutely no hope of ever coming to the U.S. Despite having refugee status, despite having passed all of the security clearances, all of the Department of State interviews, having
how many years was that process for them?
Oh, I would have to look it up, but easily 10 years, if not more.
Wow.
And those stories
Jenna,
are so
important.
If
you're listening, I'm sorry I got some of the details a little bit off, but you can call in and correct. You can call me.
I was just going to say these stories are so important because when we talk in this aggregate terms about numbers and status, it doesn't make it into a person. And then when you have a great story like what Giselle wrote, it makes it into a person.
Yeah. And so many of the refugees that come to Fresno are people who are relatives who have loved ones here are like waiting so long. I think I remember in October or November of this year, we received a family from Syria and we were so happy to have them. And they had been scheduled to come in February of 2017 and their travel had been canceled by the first Trump administration. Their sister had come in January of 2017. So by the time that these two sisters were reunited, it was like, what is that, like 6-7 years later? The sister was already a citizen. Like the whole family had already become citizens. And then this sister that was cut off, then was left behind, now is 6 years behind what she would have been if she had been admitted the first time.
So you work with a lot of people across the political spectrum. So what has been effective in your perspective to help change the narrative about refugees and what would it take to revise or turn around the current position that the administration has?
Refugee resettlement for a really long time was like the most bipartisan supported initiative that United States had. The president who admitted the most number of refugees over 4 years was the first George Bush. What about political parties? We've seen research that what changes people's mind about refugees and welcoming refugees is whether they know a refugee or not. So people who know someone and know that they came as a refugee, like support welcoming more refugees, like over 80% of people interviewed do that. If you don't know a refugee and you just know things from the headlines, then it's below 50%.
Yeah.
So I think it is a lot to ask people who have already overcome a lot and survived a lot and made things happen. But the more that people can say, look, I was a refugee and here's where I am now, that really does make a difference. And I think, I tell my staff sometimes, who protected me from my fifth grade bully? It was Samantha Yang. And Samantha Yang turned up to my bully and was like, hey, stop doing that. And the bully listened. So honestly, I wouldn't really probably have self-esteem if it wasn't for refugees. And having the incredible experience of growing up in Fresno and having folks in my classroom and having classmates and having friends who came to Fresno from all over the world, right?
That's what makes Fresno so beautiful, right?
Yeah, it's part of it.
Yeah.
It totally is. It totally is. And like refugees are what make Fresno home.
We close these podcasts with what we're loving this week. I'm going to go ahead and start this week. It's summer. I'm loving pool parties. I just went to a pool party last weekend. There was a blown up like rainbow unicorn that I was riding on with an adult beverage and I was in my happy place. So I'm just loving getting in the pool. Donnie, what are you loving?
I love a pool party and I'm planning to do that very soon. What am I loving this week? Do you want to go first?
Do you want to go first, Christine?
So the thing that I'm loving right now is the physicist drink at The Alchemist.
Ooh.
So it is ginger beer. So okay. It's like gingery and cold.
Oh, I love ginger beer.
And then they do a shot of espresso on top of
what?
It.
Ooh.
So it's so refreshing and so delightful. And then last time I went, I asked him to put like a little, just like one shot of lavender on top. And he was like, I don't know, is it going to be too sweet? And I was like, yeah, don't do like the full three shots, just like a little bit of lavender. It was divine, y'all. Wow. It was so good.
Does this have a name?
It's called The Physicist.
I know, but your version. Well, Christine's Physicist?
Maybe you could ask for that. Yeah, I'll make that the name. And they'll be like, what? And it'll be like, just a little bit of lavender.
A little bit. Excellent.
What am I loving? I am definitely loving right now. It's been a really heavy week from a news perspective. On Thursday, Senator Alex Padilla from California was wrestled to the ground by federal officials when he was asking questions during a Homeland Security press conference. The ongoing protests in LA and watching the National Guard response has been a lot. And I think I'm loving watching the way in which people are not being intimidated by the face of a really authoritarian federal government right now. Very encouraged to see that.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom.
And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.